Hello and welcome to That Time of the Night, coming to you from CBC Radio in St. John's. I'm Marjorie Doyle. In the first hour this evening, I'm going to be playing an exciting piece that Aaron Copland wrote for an American high school orchestra back in the 1930s. But first, it's Between the Covers. Tonight starts a week of stories by a writer who explores identity in different cultures. Her name is Shauna Singh Baldwin. She herself has crossed a number of borders. She was born in Montreal, she grew up in India, and she lives now in Wisconsin. In her collection, English Lessons, the stories dramatize the changing lives of Indian women. Tonight's two stories are spun from events in the lives of her great-grandmother and her mother. Here is Shauna Singh Baldwin.
Rawalpindi, 1919. Whole wheat flour and water. Not just any flour will do either, she thought. He's very particular about that. Chaudhary Amir Singh would dine on simple fare, but the first chapati must be made from the wheat of his own mills, and it must come from the hands of the mother of his sons, Sardani Sahib herself. It seems warmer than usual, she thought, as her fingers molded and formed the dough, knuckling into it, brown soft hands suppling it, readying it as she had made her sons ready. And for what, she thought. The elder, a poet. Gentle and kind, but no businessman. What would he make of the flour mill? Now the younger one, he's more worldly. 21 years old, and Chaudhary Sahib had found no bride worthy of him, yet. She made a ball of the dough, patting, patting, smoothing the wet, glistening, gold-flecked ball. Now dig a small ball out of the large one. Cut it apart from the whole. Now shape it, roll it between the palms. She looked at the small ball cradled in her hand. At this stage, she could still return it to the large ball, and no damage would be apparent. She could knead it back, and it would blend again. But this idea, who knows where it came from? This idea that her boy could go to Vilayat, to the white people's country, to learn from their gurus in their dark and cloudy cities, her youngest, and then return to Rawalpindi, and his people would know no difference? She shook her head. Hai toba. It will be different in 3 years, she thought. Today Chaudhary Amir Singh washes his hands after shake hand with an Angrez, the collector with the brown topi and the red face. But Sarup is a friendly boy, and he will have Angrez boys as friends, and he will learn the shake hand instead of our no-polluting palms together, Sat Sri Akal. A little flower on the ball now. Just a dusting, enough to swirl the ball between her thumbs and the first two fingers of her hands. Round and round, faster and faster, flatter and flatter, larger and larger, thinner and thinner. He would look thinner after 3 years. She tried to imagine him. They would expect him to tie his beard, his long, dark beard, up under his chin. She would be sure he had enough turbans to last 2 months on the boat and 3 years in England. Some silk ones, oh, the brightest colors, so the Angrez would know he came from a bold Sikh clan. But he would be thinner, with no woman to cook chapatis. Sardar Baldev Singh had been to London, and he had told her he had eaten only boiled food with not a single chili all the time. Perhaps he said it as an excuse for his appetite on his return, but she'd noticed even quite high up Angrez were thin. It must be their food. Sarup would never become used to that. She rolled the chapati with a rolling pin, picked it up and deftly slapped it from one palm to the other. Then whoosh, onto the tawa over the coal fire. She steadied the tawa with one hand and with a small rag in the other, rotated the chapati till it was almost cooked. But perhaps there were other customs he would get used to. He had already, she knew, bought an English book to read. Now it was agreed he would be studying in Vilayat. She had seen it, and it had an English woman and a man in a black English suit on the outside. They were kissing, but Sarup told her it was a classic, like the story of Rub Basant. He said all the English stories like Rub Basant are written down, and in Imperial College there were even people whose only study was to learn those stories. This one was called Thelma, he said. It was written by a woman called Mari Corilli. Now how could this be, that a woman would write such a fat book? But maybe she was a poor woman who could not afford to get a munshi to write down her thoughts. She took the chapati off the tawa. Quick, snatch the tawa off the fire and replace it with the chapati. She watched as the chapati rose into a hot air-filled dough balloon. Just at its peak, she lifted it from the fire and set it on the ground on a steel thali to cool. It was the thali that brought it to mind. Angrez don't use steel thalis. They use white plates. They don't use the chapati, breaking off a small piece to scoop up their food. They use sharp forks and long knives, straight ones, not curved like our kirpans, to keep themselves distant from their food. He will have to learn that. And as she rose from her haunches to pick up the thali and covered her head with her chunni in preparation for entering her husband's presence, she decided to talk with him about it. She moved to the doorway and stepped over the wooden threshold. A.G., she said. She would not bring him misfortune by using his name. Chaudhry Amir Singh looked up from the divan and cushions on the floor. You will need to buy chairs for this house when he returns, she said. And we will need plates. Montreal, 1962. In the dark at night, you came close, and your voice was a whisper, though there is no one here to wake. They said I could have the job if I take off my turban and cut my hair short. You did not have to say it. I saw it in your face as you took off your new coat and galoshes. I heard their voices in my head as I looked at the small white envelopes I have left in the drawer, each full of one more day's precious dollars, the last of your savings and my dowry. Mentally, I converted dollars to rupees and thought how many people in India each envelope could feed for a month. This was not how they described emigrating to Canada. I still remember them saying to you, you're a well-qualified man, we need professional people. And they talked about freedom and opportunity for those lucky enough to already speak English. No one said then, you must be reborn, white-skinned, and clean-shaven to show it, to survive. Just a few months ago, they called us exotic new Canadians, new blood to build a new country. Today, I took one of my wedding saris to the neighborhood dry cleaner, and a woman with no eyebrows held it like a dish rag as she asked me, is it a bedsheet? No, I said. Curtains? No. I took the silk back to our basement apartment, tied my hair in a tight bun, washed the heavy folds in the metal bathtub, and hung it, gold threads glinting, on a drip-dry hanger. When I had finished, I spread a bedsheet on the floor of the bathroom, filled my arms with the turbans you'd worn last week, and knelt there, surrounded by the empty soft hollows of scarlet, navy, earth brown, copper, saffron, mauve, and bright parrot green. As I waited for the bathtub to fill with warm, soapy water, I unraveled each turban, each precise spiral you had wound round your head, and soon the room was full of soft streams of muslin that had protected your long black hair. I placed each turban, in turn, on the bubbly surface and watched them grow dark and heavy, sinking slowly, softly into the warmth. When there were no more left beside me, I leaned close and reached in, working each one in a rhythm bone deep, as my mother and hers must have done before me, that their men might face the world proud. I drained the tub, and new colors swelled, deep red, dark black mud, rust, orange, soft purple, and jade green. I filled the enamel sink with clean water and starch and lifted them as someday I will lift children. When the milky bowl had fed them, my hands massaged them free of alien red-blue water. I placed them carefully in a basin and took them out into our gray two rooms to dry. I placed a chair by the window and climbed on it to tie the four corners of each turban length to the heavy curtain rod. Each one in turn I drew out 3 yards till it was folded completely in two. I grasped it firmly at its sides and swung my hands inward. The turban furrowed before me. I arced my hands outward and it became a canopy. Again inward, again outward, hands close, hands apart, as though I was back in Delhi on a flat roof under a hot sun, or perhaps near a green field of wheat stretching far to the banks of the Bias. As the water left the turbans, I began to see the room through muslin screens. The pallid walls, the radiator you try every day to turn up hotter for me. The small windows unnaturally high. When the turbans were lighter, I set the dining chairs with their half-moon backs in a row in the middle of the well-worn carpet, and I draped the turbans over their tops the way Gidda dancers wear their chunnis pinned tight in the center parting of their hair. Then I sat on the carpet before them, willing them, dance for me, dance for us. The chairs stood as stiff and wooden as ignorant Canadians, though I know maple is softer than chinar. Soon the bands of cloth regained all their color, filling the room with sheer lightness. Their splendor arched upwards, insisting upon notice, refusing the drabness, refusing obscurity, wielding the curtain rod like the strut of a defending champion. From the windows over my head came the sounds of a Montreal afternoon and the sure step of purposeful feet on the sidewalk. Somewhere, on a street named in English, where the workers speak joual, I imagined your turban making its way in the crowds, bringing you home to me. Once again, I climbed on a chair and I let your turbans loose. One by one I held them to me, folding in their defiance, hushing their unruly indignation, gentling them into temporary submission. Finally, I faced them as they sat before me. Then I chose my favorite, the red one you wear less and less, and I took it to the bedroom. I unfurled the gauzy scarlet on our bed, and it seemed as though I'd poured a pool of the sainted blood of all the sick martyrs there. So I took a corner and tied it to the doorknob, just as you do in the mornings, instead of waking me to help you. I took the diagonal corner to the very far end of the room, just as you do, and rolled the scarlet inward as best I could within the cramped four walls. I had to untie it from the doorknob again to roll the other half, as I used to, every day for my father, then my brother, and now you. Soon the scarlet rope lay ready. I placed it before the mirror and began to tie it as a sardar would, one end clenched between my teeth to anchor it, arms raised to sweep it up to the forehead, down to the nape of the neck, around again, this time higher. I wound it swiftly, deftly, till it jutted haughtily forward, adding 4 inches to my stature. Only when I had pinned the free end to the peak did I let the end clenched between my teeth fall. I took the saliva-darkened cord, pulled it back where my hair bun rested low, and tucked it up over the turban, just as you do. In the mirror, I saw my father, as he must have looked as a boy, my teenage brother, as I remember him, you, as you face Canada, myself, as I need to be. The face beneath the jaunty turban began to smile. I raised my hands to my turban's roundness, eased it from my head, and brought it before me, setting it down lightly before the mirror. It asked nothing now but that I be worthy of it. And so, my love, I will not let you cut your strong rope of hair and go without a turban into this land of strangers. The knot my father tied between my chunni and your turban is still strong between us, and it shall not fail you now. My hands will tie a turban every day upon your head and work so we can keep it there. One day our children will say, my father came to this country with very little but his turban, and my mother learned to work because no one would hire him. Then we will have taught Canadians what it takes to wear a turban.
Shauna Singh Baldwin reading 2 stories from her collection English Lessons. Tomorrow night on Between the Covers, she travels to Toronto for another story of shifting identities. I'm Marjorie Doyle. You're listening to That Time of the Night coming to you from CBC Radio in St. John's.